I tell people this is a bachelor pad with work in progress. It's not very well organized some days. This kind of stuff.
This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today I'm off-site, not in the studio. We're visiting with Mr. George Dane at his Iowa City home. George is a combat veteran of World War II. He's 92 years old. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. The Battle of the Bulge was a major German offensive over a period of about 6 weeks at the end of 1944 and the start of 1945. It was Hitler's last-ditch effort to turn the tide of the war, and it took place in France, Luxembourg, and Belgium. This hour, we're having George Dane recall the end of World War II in Europe, along with the Battle of the Bulge. It was in May of 1945 that the Allied forces accepted the unconditional surrender of Nazi Germany. George Dane sitting right across from me in his living room, in his home. George Dane, how wonderful of you to invite us out to your home. Thank you very much.
I like to do these things because the farther we go away from the date, the shorter the paragraph is in the history book. I kind of feel an obligation in a way to give these people at least one person's firsthand remembrance of what took place.
All right. Let's start when you were in high school in the late 1930s and also marked the start of the Second World War in 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. You were attending, even though you're an Iowa City native, you were up in Minnesota attending a military high school in Faribault.
Right. My dad had three wives, and his first wife had gone to the girls' school part up there, called St. Mary's. And so it was always his objective to have me to go and my brother to go because we had that intensive academic thing. And as an incidental thing, starting back around the time of the Civil War or whatever it was, they had a military department. So in the military department was the same curriculum that the university had for its 4 years of ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I got the ROTC.
So an ROTC program at Shattuck, is it Shattuck Military High School in Faribault, Minnesota? You graduated in June of 1940. So now you've written a little bit about your experiences in World War II, and I've read a little bit about it. Tell us about a visit to Fort Snelling, which is up in Minnesota there, and you had an example of talked about the machine gun company there as a demonstration of how ill prepared we were to fight this world war.
Well, it was very interesting because for some reason or other, we always fight the next war after we fought the last one. So we had this class and called the machine gun company to attack. And here came a water-cooled 1917 machine gun on two bicycle wheels pulled by a mule. And that was after the Germans had invaded Poland and the war had started.
With their motorized vehicles, the so-called Blitzkrieg that they went to Poland, and what we had you in a military high school training with was a water-cooled machine gun pulled by a mule.
Yeah, and they had the dive bombers and they had tanks and all that stuff, and we didn't.
Let me ask you about this. After you graduated from the ROTC program in high school, you enrolled at the University of Iowa in the College of Engineering. You're an engineer. That you enrolled in the fall of 1940 and then left for active duty in the summer of 1942. Tell us about the decision to leave. You had a deferment. You could have stayed in college.
And the interesting thing from that, my dad was in the First World War, stayed in the reserves for a while, and then had signed up to go back in the Second World War. Now he was 51, passed all the physicals, and he says, "I'm too old to go overseas, but I could take the place of some younger guy." Well, I didn't know that at the time until later, and I thought that'd be awful dumb sitting in the engineering school or the educational deferment, and my dad was going back for the second time. Well, I beat him by about a month before he went back. And then my brother graduated in 43. So that left my mother with no men, you might say, anymore. And so all her men were gone. Well, I always thought I'd be awful dumb sitting in the engineering school with a deferment and my dad going back.
Now, I understand because you had some engineering training and you had an interest for engineering and how mechanical things work, that you were given some basic training to help repair trucks and Jeeps and so forth.
Yeah, that was the first school I had. I had to drive every one of them, and we would actually take them apart and put them back together. And the reason for that was if something happened, I could tell the mechanic what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sent me back again to Atlanta, Georgia, and there we learned how to manage where you have a group of vehicles.
So by about December of 1943, you were promoted to first lieutenant, and then early 1944, we're getting close to the time when you're going to be shipped out to the war in Europe, but you happened to meet a young lady named Marjorie.
Yeah. I was in engineering class in the fall, about November of 1940, and I was riding with this classmate of mine. His name was Cox, and mine was D, so we had seats together. See, so he went up to the door of this house out there, and this young lady came to give him some tickets or something like that. And Art came back to the car, and I says, "Who in the world was that?" "Aye, that was just my cousin." I said, "Nobody's got a cousin unless that's good." And he wouldn't tell me her name. So finally, about February, there was some kind of a dance coming up, and I asked Art if he was going to go. He said, "No, I haven't got a date." I said, "Well, go take your cousin, and I'll drive, and we'll double date." And this, she was a junior out of City High. Well, that raised a couple of eyebrows anyway, because here were these college guys dating somebody down out the City High, see? But we didn't let that bother us. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's the way I found out. I knew where she lived, I knew what her name was, and from then on I could fly on my own, see?
And Marjorie is still here, living here in Iowa City. I want to remind our listeners that this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. George Dane of Iowa City is good enough to invite us into his home in Iowa City today to recall what happened 70 years ago, the end of World War II, 1944 and 1945. And George is a combat veteran who fought in Europe at that time. In fact, he was in a position that was overrun by the Germans in the Battle of the Bulge. We'll talk about that in a moment. George, so you're still stateside, and you've met this wonderful woman, Marjorie, who would later become your wife. What were your thoughts then about getting married and then going off to the war? And you know this was a horrible war. There were a lot of young men not coming back.
Well, that was a risk. You never knew. But anyway, I made first lieutenant in December, and Marjorie and I had corresponded, and had the plans. I went through the hoops, you know. I gave her my fraternity pin and all of this stuff. Wrote her dad, did all that good stuff. And so then we actually got married in February of 1944. I said, "Well, you know, there's the risk to this, but we'll just have to take it, but at least we'll have some time together to start with."
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any conversations there, what you said to each other? You're going off to war, a period of real uncertainty.
Well, we both knew that. Both had apprehensions about it, and we knew there was a lot of people that didn't come home. We were the wrong place at the right age. from 1937 up through 1943, a lot of the people from the school went. Everybody went. That was your job. Nobody wanted to bug out of it.
You wanted to go to war.
Well, didn't want to, but knew that that was their duty. The country needed us. And if we had a talent, we would go. Knew what the odds were with the Air Corps, all those other things. But the country needed the best they could get. And that's the ironic thing, is that it's always the best ones you have and the best ones you go, because you don't ever want to send anybody second best, you know. And so we knew that was going to be a risk, but we'll just have to see how it came out. Mm-hmm.
You, George Dane, you in the summer of 1944, I understand you got your orders then to leave for Europe. You were shipped off first to England. At this time, was still a threat of U-boats, the German submarines, in crossing the Atlantic?
Oh, yeah. As soon as we got out into the Gulf Stream, we got the destroyer escort, and we were limited to the speed of the slowest ship. So it took us 2 weeks.
And you arrived after those 2 weeks in England. After a time in England, you were told to get ready to go to France to cross the channel. And now we have to remember, this is August of 1944. D-Day was only a few weeks before you crossed.
Well,
right?
D-Day was the 6th of June, and so I was probably 2 months, 3 months behind it. But we landed in Normandy, the Omaha Beach, the same thing that the guys fought over on D-Day, and there was a little, very steep cliff. Mm-hmm. Went up a little stone path, and we went up that same path.
What evidence did you see of D-Day that took place 2 months before you arrived?
Oh, there's still a lot of debris. Those iron things that they had to poke holes in the bottom of the landing craft. A lot of the mess was still around there. They didn't clean that up at all.
Mm-hmm. What was the mood at that point? D-Day had happened. This is generally recognized as a turning point in the war to get a foothold on continental Europe. What were you feeling as a lieutenant crossing into France finally come into contact with the enemy?
Quite a bit of apprehension. You don't really know what's going to be next. Also, as I have said, everybody was there. The man that was the commander of the first replacement camp, I went to him, a high school physics teacher, and the mess officer was a classmate.
Really?
And when we got into France, and by that time the hedgerows were cleared, but the lieutenant that was loading us in the trucks to go on would have been a roommate back in Mississippi.
Hmm.
So you ran into people you knew all over the place, see?
Even though I think Americans in World War II, there were some 17 million Americans that served in the Second World War, fewer than that in combat. But you were meeting people that you had run into at various places. You got into France, and when was the first point in which you encountered fighting? You were in close proximity to fighting.
And I could remember getting in the truck and coming up to this little place that was all full of trees. I think it had been reforested, and the adjutant, the guy that is in charge of people, interviewed you, and at that time, I had this primary, MOS, occupational number anyway, of an 0600, which was a transportation officer, but my basic one was a 1542, which was an infantry unit leader. Well, the unit that I joined had come across France and slammed into the Siegfried Line, lost a lot of people, and then had a bunch of replacements. So the unit I was assigned to was a rifle company, was full, but they had to put me someplace. So they assigned me to the company commander to help him until they needed either a platoon leader or a transportation officer, one or the other. So that's how I wound up with a captain. Mm-hmm.
If you just joined us, this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and here today visiting World War II combat veteran George Dane. He's 92 years old, an Iowa City resident, and he fought in the Second World War and went to Europe in 1944 and stayed there until after the end of the war, fought in France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and we're getting some of his remembrances as we mark this year, which is the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. Let's talk, George, a little bit about the Battle of the Bulge. As I understand it, this was Adolf Hitler's strategy to make a last-ditch effort to destroy at least one of the fronts. He was working against the Russians, and he was working on the east, and he's working against fighting a two-front war, and then he's against the French and the English and the Americans in the West. So this is a chance for him to save the war by defeating at least one of those sides.
As I remember the strategy for him, he wanted to come through Bastogne, which was a key traffic center, swing northeast to the channel and cut those people up in the English part of the thing and take them out of the war. Mm-hmm. And that was his strategy, and in the meantime, hold the Russians off on the other side.
Where were you when the Battle of the Bulge started in December of 1944? When did you first get word that there was a major German offensive?
Okay, we'd been up in the Hürtgen Forest, and
what country is that in?
That's right in the corner of Belgium, up by Aachen. And I had been with the company commander there, and they had a bunch of casualties and so on. So I went back to being a transportation officer just as we left Aachen, which is up in the Hürtgen Forest, and then came down the 100 miles or whatever it was to Luxembourg. And that was a place either for units like ours that had heavy casualties and had new people coming in, or a new unit coming directly from the States. And so it was supposed to be a quiet sector because it's heavily wooded. It's down there in the Ardennes. It's supposed to have been a quiet place. Well, we were there just about 2 or 3 days, and then one morning of the 16th, this little village was kind of a resort town. It had a bunch of hotels in it. It had a railroad line ran through it and so on. And we were billeted or roomed on the east side of a little stream in a hotel. And early that morning, about 5:30 in the morning, we got a lot of artillery fire coming from the German side. Well, the first thing it did, it cut all the telephone wires. My roommate was went up to the window to see what was going on, and a shell landed in the street and filled his fanny full of glass, and so he got evacuated. But I was back further. So then we went back over to our headquarters, which was on the west side of this little stream, in about a three-story little hotel, like you see up at McGregor, where the buildings built right up against the hill or right up against the mountain.
Built into the cliff, yeah.
Yeah. Well, then that was on the 16th. Well, then on the 16th and the 17th, the people that we had up in the front lines, which was about 6 miles east of us, held out as long as they could. And when it ran out of ammunition, they were done because we couldn't get anything to them. You can get along without food, you can get along without water for a while, but you can't get along without ammunition. So the Germans got past the roadblocks we had, and that night, the second night, whatever it was, the 16th, they built some bridges, so they got tanks across the street. So they had tanks probably the morning of the 18th, the night of the 18th. Anyway, the Germans had to build the bridges to get the tanks over there. Otherwise, all they had was infantry that they brought across it in boats. And so after we got that artillery fire on the morning of the 16th, I went down to where our headquarters was in this hotel, and I guess I spent the night there. That would be the night of the 16th. And then the day of the 17th is when the Germans had their bridges across and they brought the tanks up through there.
If you've just joined us this hour, we're traveling back 70 years to the end of World War II. It's a conversation I had with 92-year-old George Dane at his Iowa City home. George is a veteran of World War II who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. That was a major German offensive. It lasted 6 weeks at the end of the war, 1944 into 1945. When we come back, George will recount how German tanks overran the town he was in, how he escaped, and also he'll share with us some of the actual gear he had with him during that time. By the way, we have pictures of George with some of that war equipment on our website, iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment with this special edition of River to River, commemorating the end of World War II. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, a special edition of the program, commemorating the end of World War II. It's a conversation I had with George Dane of Iowa City in his Iowa City home. George is a veteran of World War II who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. That was Hitler's last-ditch surprise offensive in an attempt to turn the tide of the war. Of course, it failed. The battle took place in France, Luxembourg, and Belgium. And when we left off our conversation with George, the Germans had just begun their surprise offensive, and George's unit was about to be overrun.
We had some roadblocks there, but they overran those. The tank came down into the street and must have seen some activity around. But anyway, he stopped right in front of the hotel that we were in, took his machine gun and shot out all the windows, and then turned his turret 90 degrees and fired one round through the front door of this little hotel.
The hotel you were in?
Yeah. And by coincidence, I was on the second floor. I was the transportation officer, and I was on the telephone working with the other officers, trying to line up some trucks and get some other people to come and help us when this fired through the front door. The guy that survived went to the basement, and we didn't know what we were going to do, but up on the third floor, there was a little catwalk, some 2x12s. They led on a little catwalk back to the cliff, just like I say up at McGregor, and that's where we got away. And my nephew went back, and the hotel is still there. It's used now as a regular hotel, but he said the little catwalk that we got away on is still there too.
Still there.
And I knew the road net because that was my work with the trucks. It was dark, pitch black, but you'd have any sense of a direction. But the Signal Corps had taken these 36-inch searchlights that they used to use for airplanes and then used for openings for used car lots. But anyway, and shined those off the clouds and made artificial moonlight.
Hmm.
So I could tell which way was west and which way it was east. And so naturally I went west.
And you eventually found an intact unit that had not been overrun.
Yeah. So anyway, I got past that, hooked up another guy for a little while, found some lady that fed us a little something to eat. So then on the main road that went from Bastogne back east to Clairvaux, where we were I found a part of a column of my trucks, supply trucks, that's what I was in. And so I got those guys, and they hadn't had anything to eat or anything. So I bedded them down. Must have been about 8 o'clock at night. And then we heard some noises in the background. And I said, guys, I don't like the sound of that. And I said, I think we better leave. Well, I got them up. We got them and we had six trucks, got them started. And what I heard was a German tank coming down the road. And he saw the column, and he fired at the last truck. Well, he hit the gas tank or something like that. Anyway, set it on fire, but the driver jumped out of the truck, grabbed the tailgate of the one in front, and we kept going. Mm-hmm. Well, that burning truck was in the middle of the road, so the tank couldn't follow us, you see. And so we went on back west and back to our supply dumps, and that's how we got out of that. And as we went then through Bastogne that night, that was when the airborne was coming in.
Mm-hmm. I understand a lot of the travel at this time during the fighting is frightening because you have blackout conditions, right? Even when you're traveling.
Oh, yeah, you don't have anything. I've got a flashlight around here someplace. You'll see it's carbon paper in it. So it doesn't make a flash, anything else. You've heard them see about three men on a match. You can take and light a cigarette across a valley a mile away, and that light from that cigarette will shine. By the time he lit three of them, people would know you're there, see?
Mm-hmm.
So, pitch black.
What do you remember about the day that victory was declared in the Europe, VE Day? We mark it as May 8th, 1945.
Big sigh of relief, I guess. By that time, some other units had moved in next to us, and we were not then actually engaged against the Germans at that time.
You were an occupation force.
Yeah. We did that. I suppose maybe for a month, and then when the war actually ended, then we could start shipping those people home. But that intervening month, we were trying to clean up the area. The Germans had stashed things all over. I remember one corn crib, and it was full of German carburetors. And then you go someplace else, and they had something else stashed away. See? Mm.
Tremendous devastation across Germany that you witnessed and went through. I understand your travels took you to the German city of Cologne on the Rhine, and you saw that massive cathedral, which still stands today.
Yeah, the Germans tried to protect all those historic places because they were as much interested in them that we were. When I got down to Cologne, it was sandbagged clear up to where the glass windows would be about two stories high, but the glass was all gone.
In the cathedral?
Yeah, out of the cathedral, but the cathedral hadn't been hit. There was a bomb-sheltered building or something near it, but I noticed that in the other places, Reims and some other places that I went. The other interesting thing is that as I traveled through that, once the grass grows over a place that's disturbed, it doesn't change. So I was going down this little ravine, and I kept going down to some steps, and I got to look. Those are the old trenches of World War One, and the shell holes from World War One. The grass had grown over them, and they're still there.
George, I wonder if you were many months in combat. Before you went into combat, did you wonder if you could cope with the conditions, if you could, when faced with it, kill another human?
Well, to some degree, my job did not take me into the trenches and into the foxholes. There's many of those guys would be in a foxhole, two of them, and the guy next to him got shot, and so on and so forth. I didn't have that experience or subjected to me, because that wasn't what I was to do.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to organize all these vehicles, see that they got where they were supposed to go, and when they got back. We used to say that if you're 25 yards back from the front line, you're reasonably close, and if you're 50 yards back, you're pretty safe, except for what I called M&Ms, and that's not the candy. M&M is a mine, which they were all over. You could step on one of those, or mortars, which come out of the sky and don't make any sound. Now, artillery shell spins, and it whistles, so you can hear those. But the mortars come out, they drop. They have fins on them, so they don't spin. So we always said we worried about M&Ms, but we weren't talking about the candy.
Now, the war's over, and at some point you'll get orders that you can return to the United States.
Yeah, you have to remember, shipping was a problem. The war ended probably in May, and we were probably until July until they got shipping organized. And you have to remember this: if the war is over and you're not fighting, what in the world do you need to do to keep the guys busy? You got to have to do something, see? So we had all the baseball games and all that kind of stuff we could do over there. And I remember the battalion commander went fishing. Well, he liked to fish until somebody dropped a hand grenade in his fish pond and killed all the fish. And he wasn't very happy about that. But you did your best to have something to do to keep these guys busy. And then finally, we got word that the shipping was available. So we took all our vehicles. The troops went by train, and we went back with our vehicles to Le Havre and parked our vehicles on a big airstrip there, and then climbed on a army transport and came on home.
Mm-hmm. And then you got to see your wife again, Marjorie.
Yeah. I got there first. And I was sitting there eating supper, getting ready. I heard kind of a little rustle, and I turned around. As I have said, I saw the most gorgeous pair of legs I hadn't seen in a long time. So anyway, we got together for that. And then we were to have 30 days leave, and then get ready to go to the Pacific. Because the war in Japan wasn't over yet.
Right.
And dropped the bombs. Well, We had 30 days leave, and while I was still home is when they dropped the two bombs and the war ended.
So, but before they dropped the two atomic bombs, you were thinking you were headed to the Pacific Theater.
Yeah, we were headed for the Pacific Theater, and that was not going to be good because it was an honor to die for the emperor, and the Japanese made sure that a lot of them died, and with that, they took a lot of Americans with them.
George Dane is my guest, World War II combat veteran, Iowa City resident. And George, did you lose any friends during the war?
Oh yeah. Fullback of our high school team lost an arm. Quarterback lost both legs. There's one family. They had two sons, lost them both. I think there was three families we knew that had two kids and lost them both. We were our classes, as I say, were hit real hard. You know, normal thing, you know, you'd lose 1 or 2% of your people. Some of those classes lost 10% of them. Killed, and then a lot of them wounded.
When you think back, does it seem like it's been 70 years since you had those experiences?
Well, yes and no, because some of this dims by age, but some of it is just as clear as a bell. I can remember as a first year student, and the guy that taught me close order drill as a junior, he was killed. You know, that hits you real hard. Well, you take a school that's all men, and they all have had some military experience, and at that particular age, left out a lot of holes.
Mm-hmm. How often these days do you think about the war? Every day, would you say?
No. You learn put that behind you. There's other things that take up your time, take up your thoughts. One of the other things that you learn is you don't taste too much about your experience because you never know the guy next to you that had it worse.
Yep.
And a very good friend of mine was down in the South Pacific for 15 months. Made a sergeant, did very well, came back, had 6 weeks OCS, and everybody said, well, you've done your duty, they'll keep you stateside. So then he got married. Next week he got orders to go to Germany, and he got captured. So, you know, you don't say too much. There the guy had it out worse.
Hmm. I want to ask you, you've here in your living room in your home in Iowa City, you've got some of the gear that you had from your time fighting in World War II. Can you tell us about some of that? We're going to put some pictures of these, some of the gear, on our website so our listeners can go to iowapublicradio.org, look for River to River, and we'll find some of George Dane's World War II combat gear. Let's have a look.
Well, some of this is gets changed a little bit because after I got back, another part of the story is that I was just disgustingly healthy, and I didn't think we were done fighting, so I signed on with the Army Reserve. So I spent the next 30 years with the Army Reserve. But this is the same equipment that we had at the time, and this is a entrenching tool. I'll get it pulled out of here. Now, the shovel the guys had in the First World War was just a little shovel with a T-handle and looks like a spade, but this actually has a combination on it. You loosen a nut here, and comes out, and now, this is tied it. This is like a backhoe. You can pick up the dirt and pick it out of the hole. Then you can straighten it out and tighten the nut. And then you have a straight shovel. But next, on the one edge, is sharp. And that's where you can chop. So that's a good piece of equipment. And every guy carried one. Because you stop someplace, and one of the first things you want to do, start digging yourself a hole. Then, of course, another interesting thing is your mess kit. Well, I don't know what they had in the First World War, probably a piece of tin, but this all locks together with a cover on the top and a little arm here snaps in. Then you take the little ring, it fits real tight, take that off. Then you take the handle of this mess kit and slip it through a little thing and then hook it on the limb of the other thing. Now this has got two compartments. You put your beans and one and something else in the other. And then this is a big one where you put your pancakes. And this is your knife, fork, and spoon. And one of the things we liked was a lot of times we get powdered eggs, powdered stuff. Well, if you can make pancakes out of them, that was make them edible. But I don't know the chemistry, but something to make pancakes, you got to have baking soda or something. But Dr. Lyon's tooth powder. And when he got chased out on the bulge, as you see, and I had to leave everything behind, the only thing I had was a spoon in my pocket.
When you were escaped from that hotel that had been shelled by the German tank.
Because all this stuff had stayed behind by some luck of the thing. I had a spoon in my pocket, so that's the only cooking utensil I had. I don't know for quite a while, because you know the rest of that story. I didn't have my shirt off for 6 weeks.
6 weeks you wore the same shirt. I suppose that means you didn't have a bath or a shower.
I didn't have a bath or a shower. The only thing I can remember, I don't remember how I trimmed my toenails. You did your best to keep yourself clean and do the best to look good. Because if it looked like a bum, then you actually acted like a bum. Well, let's see what else I got down here.
Let's see. You got...
Here's the flashlight.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah,
you've got your blackout flashlight.
Yeah, this is the Army issue light, but it's got a piece of carbon paper in it.
Okay, so you're holding up this green flashlight, and this is the one that you put the carbon paper on.
That and kills the flash of it. So you could probably read a map for that, but you don't have a bright flashlight light flashing around that tells somebody where you are and what you're doing. And that's a GI thing. And this will clip on your pistol belt, just like the rest of the stuff, and takes two D batteries and works real fine for that.
Been speaking this hour with George Dane of Iowa City, a 92-year-old combat veteran of World War II. And it's been, George, it's been such a joy to speak with you. Want to shake your hand and thank you for your service. And thank you for sharing these memories so that we don't ever forget them.
Well, they're important.
Thanks again to George Dane for inviting me and our producer Claire Roth into his Iowa City home for this conversation. George is a veteran of World War II who served in Europe from mid-1944 to mid-1945. You can see some photos we took of George with his equipment from the war. Also, a really touching archive photo of this young first lieutenant, George Dane, with his lovely new bride, Marjorie. Just go to iowapublicradio.org and search for River to River. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. A special thanks today to my youngest son, Liam, who tipped me off about an amazing veteran who came to visit his American Studies class in high school. That was, of course, George Dane. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.